Whether it's slots or live dealers, SpinQuest.com has the fun and action you're looking for with SpinQuest exclusives, blackjack, roulette, baccarat, and even live dice with craps and bubble craps. The games never stop, so you don't have to. And right now, new users get $30 coin packs for just $10. Play now at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
So many questions. I was just talking on my stories about how many amazing questions. There were so many questions about babies, baby-led weaning, introducing solids, toddlers who all of a sudden refuse some of their favorite foods. I totally feel you on that. My 3.5-year-old has decided that she doesn't like foods that she's liked her whole life. So I don't know if that's a phase. We're going to ask Jenny about it because I also personally would like to know for myself.
Hi. I was just listening to that intro.
I mean, there's so many great questions from people. Like I'm not surprised at how many people have questions about food and babies and toddlers. But there were a lot of questions just about all different phases of feeding and children and parenting. So thank you so much for helping us.
You're so welcome. Thank you for having us. It's good to see you.
We've talked before, but this is such a big subject for parents in all different phases. There were a ton of questions just about, you know, babies, when to introduce food, baby-led weaning, which is a big thing. And then also just like picky eating and everything. But before we do that, let's just give people a quick overview of your incredibly successful account that I feel like has taken off in the last couple of years because of parents just needing to have support in the food part of parenting and introducing foods, and just how you've become such a go-to person for moms and dads.
Yeah, no, thanks for having us, Catherine. So yeah, I mean, our story is that, you know, when I, you know, 8 years ago was first starting solids, I got that, like, I think a half page tear off from my pediatrician that said, you know, 4 tablespoons of rice cereal and X tablespoons of, you know, fruit puree and this and that. And I was like, wait, this is all I get? Like this half piece of paper. Yeah. And I was incredibly nervous. I was terrified of choking. I was terrified of, you know, allergies and allergic reactions. And turns out, rightfully so, my child has 3 life-threatening allergies. And, you know, I wanted to create a resource that showed parents you could take almost any food in your unique food culture, whatever that might be. And, modify it in a way that's safe for babies. And it turns out that the vast majority of the foods that we eat, we think adult foods, can be made safe for babies with, you know, minimal modification, whether that's some little bit of cooking or a mashing, or even going in the more kind of resistive route of like an unbreakable, you know, food teether. And so we're really trying to help reduce the anxiety around feeding our babies, but also showing an easy kind of visual how to do this. So most people download our app, and there you can find how to cut almost any food for your baby. The app is free. The entire food database there is free. It'll be free forever as long as I'm here. it's kind of taken off. I'm told it's in like the top 10% of the world of apps, which is like blowing my mind because I'm not an app person, but here we are.
Yeah. I mean, it's so helpful because I feel like, you know, especially with parents in the past couple of years, this whole concept of baby-led weaning, you talk to like anybody who's a grandparent right now. You know, I even look at my mom and everybody's like, don't you just start with, you know, little pureed foods, like, you know, like they did when we were younger. So it's definitely, there are a lot of new trends in all different forms of parenting, but also especially in the food space. So figuring out what's the right way to do it, also wanting to be safe and not have, you know, an allergy that's a life-threatening one or experiencing that and wanting to be mindful, of course,
and choking. And you know what? There's a big spoiler here. There isn't a perfect right way to do things. And I think one of the unintended consequences of the boom of commercial baby food in the 1920s and 50s and beyond was that it kind of primed our parents, our grandparents, and to think that feeding babies has to be done in this very structured stage way. And stage one, you know, textureless purees, applesauce is the only thing a 6-month-old can have. And then when they start to crawl, you can have stage two and it can be kind of lumpy. And then stage three can, you know, be more like chewable foods, when in reality, that's not even how babies learn to chew. But they didn't know that back then. We know that now. So here we are. But I think that I was just on with a reporter, actually, the magazine, writing a story. And she was asking me a very similar question that you were kind of going into. And you know, she asked me, like, what's your hope for this next generation of parents? And I said, my hope is that they start to trust themselves more, because there's so much in our intuition that, you know, is right for our child. And I think that at the end of the day, my hope is that we start trusting ourselves more as parents, as moms, as fathers, whatever, but also as trusting our children. Our babies are quite capable, and more capable than I think we give them credit for. But in the age of social media and Google and bot written articles of ChatGPT, yes, it can be very overwhelming to cut through the noise, but you also don't have to look for the noise, right? So I think that we were in some ways all born to be parents. Just like our babies were born to eat, they know that they're hungry or they're full from day one. Most typically developing infants do. And I think for us, my hope is that we can start trusting ourselves more.
I think that's such a great message to have for parents, because we do get so caught up in all of this, you know, easy access of information and Googling things and looking at different accounts that scare us or make us nervous about choking or allergies. And, you know, there are obviously all of these products that have come out that make feeding more simple, whether it's pouches or nutritious pouches, et cetera. But there's also a lot of, you know, companies that specify in just figuring out your kid's allergies. And then you say, like, do I need to do that too? Am I a bad parent if I don't do the allergy route? So I think that the idea of trusting your gut as a parent is such a powerful one. And you hear all these stories, whether it's with food or sickness or, you know, your child's development, where parents trust their gut and end up being, you know, right about a lot of things. So I think that's a great message. When it comes to feeding, I feel like there were so many questions from people who wanted to know, when do you even start? You know, we're sent home from the hospital when you have a baby. If you're a first time parent and you're like, here's some formula or good luck breastfeeding and, you know, be on your way. But there are so many people who also say you can actually start introducing solids at 3 months, and then it's now 6 months, it's 5. So when do you start introducing solids, and what's the best to start with?
Yeah. We're confused for good reason. The recommendations have changed dramatically over the last 50 years in particular. So, gosh, in 1880, the average age of starting solids was 11 months old, right? So you kind of think it kind of renders baby food as we know it completely unnecessary. This is a child that likely has teeth, has fine motor skills, you know, the ability to chew and spit and swallow and all the things you need to do to be a safe eater. And in fast forward through the boom of industrialized commercial baby food, and the average age of starting solids plummeted to, wait for it, 4 to 6 weeks of age.
Oh my gosh,
weeks old. So a child who can't even hold their head up, it's still bumping around, you know, it's not safe eating. You have to recline them to feed them. So we're now, parents today are now sort of riding the coattails of that history in a big correction. And the most medical institutions around the world, you know, WHO, AAP, and so forth, have rallied around 6 months of age as the optimal time for introducing solid food for a number of reasons. One, around 6 months of age, your baby's iron stores, so in utero, an infant or a fetus stores iron from the mother's body. Around 6 months of age, those stores of iron start to deplete. They've used them up, and breast milk and formula won't have enough to sustain them for, you know, many months beyond that. So it's a good time to start supplementing with solid food and ideally iron-rich food.
Ugh, I have had no luck lately. Wait, lady luck?
Britsky, I got you. I've had so much luck on SpinQuest.com. They have all of my favorite games, slot games, live blackjack craps, and bubble craps. You can even get a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
10 bucks for 30? I'm headed over to SpinQuest.com right now.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
Also at 6 months, there's a couple of other things happening that are very, very interesting. One, a baby is starting to be able to sit up properly and have the proper kind of trunk and core strength to sit in a high chair and to be in an upright position safely, you know, taking in food. The other thing is that they are able to reach to, I sort of cognitively identify something, reach out and grab it and bring it to their mouth. So medical institutions and, you know, occupational therapists, infant swallowing specialists are rallying around 6 months of age. But the age is somewhat arbitrary. It's really more of that's typically when these developmental milestones start to show themselves. So we're looking for a baby who is able to sit upright. So they do not need to be fed in a reclined position. If you have a high chair that is reclined, put a pillow or something behind them to make that baby fully, you know, straight up. The more you recline a child, the more likely it is. The risk of choking increases, right? So you want a baby who can sit up, you know, relatively stable in the high chair, right? They can do a little bit of support needed is okay. You want the baby to be able to have some head and neck control. We don't want to see this kind of bobbing around, right? We want them to be able to look, reach, and grab and sort of cognitively define. When the brain says, I see that food, I'm going to go grab that food, I'm going to bring that food to my mouth and, you know, take a bite, the brain is more primed and ready to coordinate the safe patterns and muscle movements needed for a safe swallow. This is really important because what we know from research and evidence is that when humans of any age feed themselves, it's safer. The risk of choking actually decreases. This is just not something that, you know, the 1920s baby food corporations really knew back then. Even nutrition was kind of a new science back then. Right. So we're really now rallying around 6 months of age, but in more looking for the developmental milestones of readiness for solid food. The other one that you kind of want to look for is just simply interest. You can imagine, if a baby is kind of like this and not really interested and you're kind of coming at them and putting something in their mouth, I mean, honestly, close your eyes and imagine someone like even just putting something in your mouth. It can feel really invasive. Yeah. And you'll see the natural kind of impulses to kind of pull away from something coming at someone's face or putting something in their mouth. We want to see some level of interest from the baby, whether it's just, I'm going to grab that, yeah, or whatever that might be, so that their brain is deciding, yes, I'm going to take a bite from that. I'm going to explore that with my mouth. And also so you're not setting yourself up for battles. And, you know, here's the thing. If you have a 6-month-old or 7-month-old baby right now, and you're like, oh my gosh, my baby's not sitting. They don't have head control. They don't have any interest. Like everything's going wrong. Just trust that even 1 week of unrestricted floor time or floor play can kind of boost them to where they need to be. Infants develop so rapidly in the first year of life that you can take a child 1 week before who can't sit without toppling over, can't reach and grab things, isn't holding their head up, and then 1 week of you know, a little bit more tummy time or floor play, and boom, they're there. So trust the process, trust that your child will get there. And if your child's not there, have a chat with your pediatrician and see if they might need some additional OT support or, therapy that way.
I was laughing when you said the interest in food, because that was a really big question that came up from so many people of kids at, 6 months of age, not being interested in food. And then also kids who are 12 months old and beyond, of just either not being interested in food, not having a desire to eat it, and parents being nervous that it's affecting their nutritional support and their kind of just overall vitamin, protein, mineral intake of food. So for people who have kids that just simply are not foodies, like my older daughter is not interested in food at all. My younger one loves it. Just totally different. Yeah. And so for parents who are stressed or nervous about, their kids not being interested in food and not getting enough nutritional support from their food, do you have any advice on that?
I do. First, I'm going to take us back a little bit, because I think inherently, and particularly those of us in Western countries where, it's like, congratulations, you're pregnant. Let's measure your baby now. How big is it? Right? Like that stays with us from the very moment we find out that we're pregnant, right to birth. Congratulations, you birthed a baby. Let's go weigh the baby. Right. And I think that those constant, milestones and measuring, and it's almost like it's as if our job is just to grow this thing. And like, that's your sole purpose in life, is to make sure that they eat enough and that they grow and thrive. And of course, that's an inherent, desire as well. But I think that if you were to talk to our feeding therapists, we have a number of infant feeding therapists on our team, as well as pediatricians, and what they see more often than not is that the worries of consumption. So is my baby eating enough? Are they eating the right enough vitamins? Or my baby's, surely you need the last scoop from this jar, that last pouch, because the pouch told you it was this size and that's that size for that age. Right. That often when parents worry too much about consumption, it can actually create a bit of a downward spiral with the parent-child relationship, that, at one extreme ends in force feeding, right? And more common scenario ends in maybe some unintended pressure, not you don't want to pressure your child, but you're nervous, you're scared, they may not be growing, they might be below the weight curve that their pediatrician wants to see. And so you want one more bite, try one more thing. It kind of comes out, and babies can sniff pressure from a mile away. But that said, there are kids, just like you're talking about the differences between your two and how wildly different they are. We are all so different. And there are gonna be kids who are just like stuffing their faces and so enthusiastic, and they don't care about the mess. And there are going to be kids like, get that off my hand, and I'm not enjoying this experience. And the why behind that is typically unique to each child. But what I will say is there are some sort of common, let me just say, if you were to come to our, if we had an office and you were to come in and say, my baby's not eating or my toddler's not eating well, we're going to ask you a series of questions, not unlike an intake, right? Intake at a hospital. And so I will tell you that maybe 80% of those situations involve the over intake of breast milk formula or cow's milk. Right. So the first question we typically ask is, well, how much milk is your child drinking? And is that milk sort of within the range? And it's a wide range, but was it within the range for the age of that baby or child? In toddlerhood, we often just see the consumption of cow milk is displacing the sort of space in the belly and interest for solid food. When we're talking about starting solids, we're actually talking about taking an infant from a purely liquid diet to chewing and putting work into getting their nutrients. It's so much harder and so much more work for the child to chew a protein. And you think about the foods that are like iron rich or, densely nutritious, a lot of them require some effort to break down in the mouth. Right. And, it's not surprising that many infants and toddlers prefer the thing that they knew best, which was the liquid. And also it's often that those liquids, the breast milk, the formula, the cow's milk, are being delivered in a very kind of loving, nurturing way. And so the first question we would ask is, how much milk is the child drinking? And, let's get that sort of in the right range. For those of you who are like, what's the right range? Just go to solidstarts.com. There's all the infographics you need. Type in milk and there's a nice little infographic by age there. The next question we would ask is, what's the feeding schedule? You would be amazed at how these very small, simple changes to a feeding schedule can radically alter the interest of a child wanting to come to the table. It's a little bit like how you may have heard, you know, your mom or your grandma say, like, don't do this, you'll spoil your dinner.
Right.
Or don't eat that snack, you'll ruin your dinner. It's kind of true.
Yeah.
Like we need sort of predictable rhythms between our main meals and between snack and main meals that help our body regulate hunger and satiety. And the child needs to learn satiety. Like, we do know when they're full, but they don't cognitively know that they're full because they ate that food yet, especially a young infant. So they're still learning that, oh, my belly feels hungry. And when I eat this, then I feel better. And that's because I ate that food, right? That's a learning that happens through starting solids. So what you kind of want to do is just make breakfast at the same time each day if you can, lunch at the same time, and dinner relatively at the same time. And yeah, you know, if you want your child to show up for dinner and to be interested in dinner, don't put snack, you know, right before for dinner.
Hanging out at the pool is great. Relaxing and playing Vegas-style games on my phone at the same time. Drink in one hand and a blackjack in the other. It's all at SpinQuest. Over 1,000 games, including your favorite slots and table games. Be cool with this summer special. New players get $30 coin packs for 10 at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
We see a lot of, particularly with parents, and I definitely fell into this trap years ago with my firstborn. We see a lot of grazing through toddlerhood. They're, can I have a snack? 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 And there's nothing wrong with that. And if your child is eating their main meals and you're happy with how things are going and they're energetic and they seem to be thriving, go for it, right? They might just need that more frequent, kind of dripping throughout the day. But more often than not, the smaller those windows of space between the main meals get, so like, you know, whether it's a half hour or 90 minutes between the last snack and the main meal, typically like in age 2 to 3, it's like 90 minutes is a good space between snack and dinner or the last meal and the next snack. The smaller those windows get, the less hungry they're going to be. And with all the distractions of toddlerhood in particular, the learning the new skills and wanting to constantly get up from their high chair, you know, all the things that they want to do, there's a lot kind of competing for their attention. So if they're not really hungry, they're not likely to show up and eat. So those are, I would say those two questions alone wipe out a lot of issues. For the deeper kind of question that you're asking about, like, what about the child who's just like, just really doesn't seem interested? We have a food refusal guide, especially for babies. If your baby is really not interested in eating or not interested in taking the bottle, we have food refusal guides on our website. But you kind of have to chase the why.
Right.
Like, why is it? For one child, it might be just separation anxiety. You know, that whatever the place they're eating or how they're eating or who they're eating with is not who they want to be with or where they want to be. For another child, it might be because they had some sort of negative experience while they were eating. Maybe they had a bad gag or they had reflux and vomited a lot when they were starting solids and it physically hurt them. So it's going to range from child to child. And this really kind of goes back to what I was saying at the beginning of our call, was that try to trust yourself first before you hunt down on Google or hunt down even here, you know, information, because you know your baby best. And if you're sniffing at something's off, something probably is off. They might be getting sick or they might be teething, or there might be something deeper going on that's worth looking into. But not every kid's going to be the same. And I think my hope for this generation of parents is that they can be in tune and, you know, we kind of call it responsive feeding, like really look for your child's cues. If they're kind of going like this, it's okay to end the meal. Know that most kids, most typically developing kids, will eat exactly the amount that their body needs. And so let your pediatrician, let your healthcare provider worry about their weight or whether they're tracking along. Try not to worry about that day to day. Focus on the whole week of intake as opposed to this day, or they skipped this snack or they skipped this breakfast. And usually things, for most kids, usually things kind of settle out and even out. The kids will be all right.
When you were talking about the kind of gagging or, vomiting, there were so many people who asked about gagging and vomiting and just parents who are nervous about their children choking, especially with, you know, the idea of baby-led pain of kids, you know, picking something up. And I know on your app, you have so many great ways for parents to feel comfortable and confident with how they're choosing to serve food and different foods to their children that are safe for them. But for kids who, there were a couple of parents who asked about kids who are constantly gagging and kids who are vomiting after eating meals that are not allergy related, but just a constant experience of gagging and vomiting post-eating.
Yeah. There are two mind-blowing things here. First, for babies who have overly sensitive gag reflex or who have reflux, you know, something that might be kind of triggering the throat muscles to contract and to vomit during meals, go in the totally opposite direction that you think you need to, which is unbreakable sticks of food. So I'm talking corn on the cob, meat on the bone, a mango pit, like the inner seed of a mango, that unbreakable kind of hard. Our feeding therapists call these food teethers or resistive sticks of food. And what those do is they put a lot of sensory pressure onto the tongue and desensitize the gag reflex in a safe way, right? Because the baby can't shove the whole corn on the cob in there. It forces them to start taking bites. It strengthens the jaws. But more importantly, it helps the brain form a mental map of the mouth. When your baby is starting solids at like 6 months of age, let's say this, like, you know, if you eat a hard boiled egg and there's like a little piece of shell still on there, like your brain will be like, oh, there's some shell in my mouth, and kind of wiggle it out, and you will spit it out almost without thinking of doing it, right? It happens almost automatically. That's because your brain has formed a mental map of your mouth. It knows when something's over here versus over here and how big it is and how small it is. And your tongue has formed the articulation to move it and spit it out. A young baby doesn't have that. And so you actually want to go bigger when it comes to food for babies who are lacking that mental map of the mouth. And all that poking and prodding and sucking and munching and chewing helps the brain in a repeated way form these kind of pathways and go, oh yeah, that's this and that's this, and I can relax the gag reflex now. Right. So the sort of feeding therapy approach that our feeding therapists often take is offering really hard sticks of food teethers, and we have a list of those on our website if you want to see those, and also probably a few reels as well. So that's for the like really gaggy babies. Go big, go really resistive, unbreakable. It advances the skills in a safe way, and you can dip those food teethers in puree or like hummus or mashes and almost use them as the utensil so that you're getting some food in the belly, but in a also advancing those oral motor skills. So that's for the really gaggy babies. But for the other sort of thing that I want to share that I learned when working with the medical team that we have is this crazy mind-blowing fact, which is that the longer your child is exclusively eating textureless food, okay, so only textureless food, the more they're going to gag later on when they're introduced to chewable food.
And textureless
and the longer,
food, you mean
like purees, velvet, okay, like something you might make in a Vitamix or, you know, like a completely blended puree baby food, right? So something that's like a velvety puree, applesauce, okay? Like applesauce versus, you know, an apple. Okay. The longer a baby or child is, you know, kind of sucking the pouches and doing textureless food exclusively, okay? Mm-hmm. These are not, these products have a role in our lives for sure. Adult food has textureless food in it as well. Soups, you know, applesauce, whatever. But the longer you're exclusively doing that, only doing that, the more likely it is, this is documented in research, the more likely it is that your child will gag more when they're introduced to chewable food and gag for longer periods of time as well. So I think that one of the sort of unintended consequences of the boom of commercial baby food was that we had this notion that you have to do this kind of order and it has to start with textureless food. But in reality, we're seeing that not only is that unnecessary, but maybe even not ideal for advancing oral motor skills and teaching kids to be safe eaters, that the longer we're kind of serving a baby food, as it were, the more you're kind of kicking the can down on the road of helping their brain and their body learn the skills that we need to eat. It turns out that to teach a baby to chew thoroughly and to become a safe eater, you have to actually offer chewable foods. There's no sort of gradual way of easing into that.
And when can you start to add in textured foods if you're somebody who's like, you know, nervous about like a kernel of corn getting in the kid's mouth when you offer them a big,
all the kernels off the corn cob.
Okay.
Shave them off, because the benefit of that corn cob as a food teether isn't the corn kernels.
Yeah.
The benefit is the unbreakable pressure that it's putting into that. First of all, the baby can grab it independently,
right,
and repeatedly kind of poke the mouth and munch and chew and bite. Even if there's no corn on there, those jaws, that phasic bite is going to kick in, those reflexes,
right,
and those repeated motions help teach the brain how to do it. So for the parents who are really nervous about offering chewable food or textured food or finger food right away, or who are really like, no, baby, that means not for me, that's okay. Start with food teethers. The brain learns better in context, meaning if you offer a plastic teether to a child, will it help advance oral motor skills? Yeah, a little bit, but not as fast or as quickly or as effectively as a food teether. The brain learns better in context. So if you're nervous, start with food teethers, dip them in, you know, iron-rich purees like hummus or bean mashes or what have you. Use those food teethers as the utensil. Let the child self-feed. It's safer and it's advancing a number of skills that will serve them going forward and make your life a lot easier as well. And then as soon as you're ready, move to, table food and finger foods.
So and also,
I think for us, the goal is to have the child self-feeding, whether that's finger dipping into applesauce and licking their finger or picking up a hunk of, steak or whatever and munching on that. I feel like I'm mentioning steak too much on your account, but
no, I mean, it's a real thing. I feel like it's also, you know, we've talked so much on BD, maybe also when it comes to food, about the importance of kids sitting at mealtime with their families and not isolating it and having it not be like a shared family experience, which is also, you know, for a lot of different cultures, having their kids at the meal and eating what they're eating is a really big part of just life. And so I think like this idea going back to, you know, trusting your gut and also how generations before us have managed to, you know, have their kids learn to eat and also eat food. And also knowing that like when someone told me with my first daughter that, you know, the gagging is a good thing. Like it's their reflexes also just like doing what they need to do. Every time in the beginning, when as a first time parent, I saw her gag and I was like, oh my God,
it looks scary.
And
you feel like you've done something wrong. And I think that that's just a sort of natural thing. When you learn about infant swallowing and you really see how all this works, there's two things that helped me relax as a parent that I'll offer here. And one is that, well, yes, gagging is good. Say it over and over and over in your head until, you know, it's kind of like write it on the chalkboard 500 times until you believe it yourself. Gagging is good. It means the body's doing exactly what it needs to do to protect the airway. It does not mean that you cut the food wrong or that your baby's not ready or that you need to revert back to purees or that your baby's not ready for chewable food. It simply means that your baby's brain is not used to this texture of food on their tongue and they need more practice. Mm-hmm. That's all it means. And the only way, unfortunately, is through. There's no way around it. waiting longer to offer chewable food will increase gagging and also increase the risk of choking later in toddlerhood, because the gag reflex for an infant is here. You and I, for us, it's back here. Right. So toward 12 months of age, that gag reflex starts to move, the trigger point starts to move further back into the throat. We want to actually help babies learn to do challenging foods and chewable foods when the gag reflex is forward, because it's more easily triggered and it's more protective. It's kind of in a heightened awareness state. It's almost like the perfect time to learn how to make mistakes. It's actually harder for a six-month-old baby to choke on food than it is for a one-year-old child. Yeah. The body's automatic reflexes, and the gag reflex is just one of those protective reflexes. There are four. But the body's automatic reflexes are in this very heightened state of awareness and protection for babies. So in a lot of ways, it can look like, oh, that looks wrong. That looks unnatural. That doesn't look right. But in a lot of ways, from a feeding therapist perspective or a swallowing specialist perspective, they're like, no, that's actually the perfect time to learn and make mistakes, because some of those the reflexes don't fully go away by 12 months of age. They're obviously, we have a gag reflex. We'll cough if something goes down our airway. Mm-hmm. You know, those are always in there, but the food has to get further back to trigger those reflexes in an older child. So it's a bit counterintuitive, that part. Yeah, your baby is born to eat, and their body really has your back. The risk of choking has been unfortunately reported in media. I think because they confuse how the CDC categorizes data. I don't think it's intentional, but you'll often see things like choking is the leading cause of death in infants and children. It's less than 0.5%. Deaths from choking mm-hmm. under age 4.
Yeah.
And 0.5% of those incidents are on objects, coins, marbles, toy parts, not food. Yeah. The risk of choking on food, whether in infancy or toddlerhood, is really quite low. It's less than 1%. So I hope that gives everyone some calm that, yeah, it might feel counterintuitive when you see your baby gag. Gagging is good. Write it a million times until you believe it yourself. And know that the baby's body was really designed to learn how to eat. In a lot of ways, the construct of baby food, it wasn't a commercial invention, right? Yeah. And parents were always kind of straining things or mashing things, but there was never like these powerful machines that made it completely velvety and completely textureless, right? So even, you know, if you zoom back 100 years, you had parents who were pre-masticating the meat for children, chewing the meat and then handing it over. So it's actually only in the last 100 years that our babies have had kind of like pudding like textures or watery carrots in a jar or a pouch and in that kind of form. And I think, you know, our app, hopefully you can go look at it. You know, those of you following, and you can look up any food. We have almost 400 foods in the app now. We're trying to get every food in the world in there, which is about 1500 is my estimation, but you can go in the app and look up how to make it safe for your baby. So just remember, your baby's body was designed to do this and designed to protect itself.
Thank you so much for all this information. I feel like we have to come back and just do one specifically on toddlers, because I myself, with my toddlers, I need more info on that. And there were also so many great questions that were just on toddlerhood. So we'll definitely come back and do another one that is toddler specific, because I know that there are so many people who are wondering, you know, about picky eating, also about kids, you know, all of a sudden waking up and refusing to eat foods that they've typically eaten. So I definitely want to come back and do that, because there were so many great questions.
I'll give you my one billboard like tip from our feeding therapy team on toddlers that can work in picky eating situations and you know, sort of run-of-the-mill toddler issues, which is this: feign indifference. Act as if it's not bothering you. Oh, you don't want to eat your dinner tonight? Okay, that's all right. There'll be breakfast tomorrow. Let's go ahead and wrap it up. You might be like really riled up inside. You may have put a lot of effort into that meal. You might be terrified that they're missing a meal. But the more we kind of hover and prod and push and poke and all of that, the less the child is likely to eat. If you want your child to eat more, we have to pressure them less and create the conditions for choice. You may have realized already that, like, getting out the door or getting, you know, your child to daycare or to school, it's like, okay, do you want to wear the blue shoes or the red shoes? Do you want your green cup or do you want your blue cup? And those little micro choices help them feel in control during the day. So my sort of billboard thing is fake it until you make it, feign indifference, try not to let it rile you up. Don't, you know, bring a ton of emotion or reaction to what they're doing in food refusal and things like that. And create choices served at the same time. Most toddlers, if they're presented with choices that feel a little bit more in control and they know there's no pressure to try that food, no pressure to eat that meal, you're truly, truly okay. If they get up and storm away saying it was the worst dinner ever, you're going to, okay, I hear you don't want to eat dinner tonight. All right, there'll be breakfast tomorrow.
Yeah.
Most kids will start to come back around. And sometimes that same kid, 15 minutes later, will come right back to the table. So try to enjoy your meal, model enjoying your meal, and truly be okay if your child doesn't want to eat that day. If it's happening a lot, talk to your doctor and get some support. Yeah. There's lots of support for that. But yeah, fake it until you make it, feign indifference and offer choice.
Love it. Well, thank you so much. I want everybody to know we are. I saw a lot of people saying, are we going to reshare this? Yes, you can rewatch this. Also, your account has such amazing information, such amazing posts. And also your app is like incredible for everyone wondering how you serve different foods, what foods to serve, different ideas, and just really a lot of support as with new parents, especially just trying to figure out how to do it and feel supported with feeding their kids. So thank you so much. We'll do this again. It was so great to talk to
Sounds
you.
Good.
And thank you.
Take care, everything. Thanks, Catherine. Nice seeing you.
Nice seeing you too.
Happy birthday, America. It's time to celebrate and play your favorite Las Vegas casino games by American-owned SpinQuest.com. What's better than fireworks and American pie? Hitting a blackjack in the palm of your hand, and you won't lose your fingers. Over 1,000 games, including slots and live dealers, and $30 coin packs are on sale for $10. SpinQuest.com. Buy American players for American players.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.